I'm Anna Sale in for Leonard Lopate today. Empathy is having a moment. It comes up when we talk about bullying, social policy, autism, and psychology. President Obama has called for greater empathy by Americans. So for this week's Please Explain, we're finding out exactly what empathy is and about its role in human psychology, behavior, and relationships. Joining us are Paul Bloom, professor of psychology and cognitive science at Yale University. His latest book is Just Babies, The Origins of Good and Evil. It's published by Crown. And Leslie Jamison is also here. She's the author of a new book of essays called The Empathy Exams, which is published by Gray Wolf Press. And we invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. You can call us at 212-433-9692. Leave a question on our show page at WNYC or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Paul Bloom, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me on.
And Leslie Jamison, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me as well. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Leslie. How you doing?
Good.
Paul, let's start with how you define empathy. How is it different from sympathy?
So there's a lot of different definitions going around. The psychologist Dan Batson lists 9 of them in this book. But the way most people think about it is putting yourself in somebody's shoes. Seeing the world as they do, feeling their pain, mirroring their thoughts. And it differs from sympathy in that empathy is in some way a broader concept. So sympathy often refers to when you have a painful experience, I sympathize and I care about it. But empathy could be broader. So if you're having the time of your life and I'm empathizing with you, some of your pleasure will end up in my head. And so it's sort of a broader notion.
Leslie, when you write about empathy, You tend to focus on the pain part of empathy. You call yourself a wound dweller.
I was called a wound dweller.
You were called a wound dweller. You admit it in your collection of essays.
I found that in my own sort of more informal anthropological experiences of investigating empathy that I was drawn to painful situations or experiences as points of extremity or access to people, their kind of interior sense of the world. There was something about that extremity, the extremity of pain, that felt like a useful limit case.
Paul, what happens when we feel empathy? How do researchers see what's happening when we psychologically experience empathy?
Well, there's been psychological studies and there's been recent studies from neuroscience, and what happens in the experience of empathy is, in some sense, we literally feel what the other person feels. So there are studies where subjects watch somebody bang their finger with a hammer, and then it turns out if you're empathetic towards that person, parts of the brain that would activate if you hurt your own finger would light up. So we really do, in the experience of empathy, we could fully mirror someone else's experience, or at least try to. And then there's research by suggesting that if you feel empathy for somebody, it motivates kindness. It motivates you to want to help them, to want to alleviate their pain, to want to reach out to them.
And what are the origins of empathy? What's the usefulness for us in terms of survival?
Well, it's an interesting question. So Franz De Waal argues you could find empathy in other primates, and some signs of empathy even in rats. The origins are probably that it motivates... kindness toward those close to you. And, you know, in our evolutionary world in which we lived in as social creatures, some degree of compassion and kindness is adaptive. Because if I'm kind to you, then you'll be kind to me back. If I'm cruel to you, you may not want to interact with me, and so I'll suffer. So biologists are now seeing some degree of morality, some degree of kindness as a biological adaptation.
Leslie Jamison, the title essay in your collection, The Empathy Exams, is about your experience being a medical actor, when part of your job was to demonstrate you had a certain illness for doctors in training, and they had to figure out what was happening. What did that experience teach you about the transactions involved in empathy?
Well, there were a few different directions that experience made me think about empathy from. And one, I mean, starting with when I was inhabiting any given case, I mean, I was going through some process of empathy to think about, well, if I was actually going through this, what would that look like? What sorts of body gestures? What sorts of statements? How would I hold myself? And then I was starting to think about also what doctors were going through when they were on the other side of that transaction. And that also changed the way that I experienced being a patient as well. But the crucial way that it started me thinking about what constitutes empathy and how we might evaluate it is just that after the every encounter I had with a medical student, I was then grading them on how well they had done, how well they had figured out what was wrong with me, and how there was this checklist item 31, how well they had voiced their empathy or compassion for my situation. And the fact that it showed up in such a concrete, quantifiable way on those surveys made me think about how, you know, we're doing that always, all the time, anyway. We're grading other people on how well they empathize with us. We're grading ourselves on how well we empathize with other people. And so it sort of brought into crystallized relief something that in a more nebulous way I think is always a part of our experiences.
So how did you find yourself defining whether that checkbox would be checked or not? What felt like someone was demonstrating empathy towards you?
Well, I think one of the ways that my feelings about empathy changed was I have always been prone to privileging authenticity of emotion, whatever that word means, but that something would be sort of instinctively felt and that you could sort of sense that in everything about a person's voice, how they were carrying themselves, how they were looking you in the eye. And, you know, part of the idea behind the training program is that empathy wouldn't just be instinctive. It could be a set of behaviors that could be taught and then practiced, a set of protocols. And I was initially very resistant to that idea. It felt sort of rote or hollow to me. But I started thinking there is some value in that, that you can sort of train certain muscles to put yourself in positions by asking questions, by being willing to listen to the responses. You might be able to take those more intentional actions that could open up moments of more genuine kind of empathy.
One of the moments in your essay when I just like, it was an amazing moment for me because you're talking about your experience with a couple of different doctors. One is a woman, one is a man. The man treats you as very sort of straightforward, and the woman also treats you in a straightforward, but you have a much more emotional reaction to the woman physician, and you say, when you're talking about the male physician, oh, I didn't need him to be my mother for just that moment. What do you think about our expectations about how we feel empathy? How are they gendered?
That's a great question. I was trying to be honest in that moment about some of the subjective factors that are probably at play all the time for me and my expectations from other people and moments, especially those moments in which I judge them harshly or feel I've failed to receive something that was my due from them. I do think that we have cultural expectations about caretaking from women that can be unfair and can set up double standards that don't serve anyone well. Another thing that was at play in that moment for me was thinking about this doctor, the male doctor that you mentioned, who wasn't doing a lot of saying, oh, that must be really hard, but I felt he was being very empathetic anyway because he was thinking about what I might be experiencing and what kinds of questions I might be having and was addressing those questions sometimes even before I thought to formulate them. And so that to me was a different vision of what empathy might look like, trying to understand my experience and offer me something inside that experience that didn't quite take the form of, oh, you look like you're in pain, I feel for you right now, which was sort of the default notion that I'd had of empathy in my mind.
Paul, do women and men feel empathy differently?
There's some evidence that women have more empathy than men. If you give these people different scales, there's typically a sex difference. And even early on, baby girls will cry more to the pain of others than baby boys. It's not a huge difference, but it's a pretty reliable difference. And it kind of corresponds with what is a big difference, which is that males are much more prone to physical violence than women.
And how do you measure levels of empathy again?
Well, one way the way it's typically done, and it's not such a good way, is you give people a scale and you ask them all sorts of questions, like questions like, you know, when I see somebody crying, I get upset, or you know, I laughter is very contagious for me. But you could also do it in more directed ways. You could see with babies what makes them cry. You could see babies what makes them help. With adults, you could even look at brain activation. You could see willingness to intervene, willingness to volunteer. Those are different measures of empathy.
How important is life experience in being in the amount of empathy you feel, Paul? If you've suffered some sort of pain, are you more prone to feel empathetic to someone else feeling pain?
I think so. I think, you know, we're talking now about the positive side of empathy, but there's a lot to be said about the negative sides of empathy. And one negative side of empathy is how selective it is. And I think the selectivity comes from, as you're putting it, from life experience. We're far more empathetic to people who we've grown up with, who we view as part of our group. It's very hard to be empathetic towards strangers. we feel a lot more empathy when it's towards a circumstance that we're familiar with than a strange circumstance. So I'd be very empathetic towards a professor who's in some sort of trouble. But towards a novelist, it's harder.
Leslie, do you think experiencing empathy requires imagination?
I do. I think that empathy, as I've experienced it, is a complicated intertwining of imagination and some form of absorption, whether that absorption is listening or research or simply being open to what you're seeing. And I think that perhaps imagination can begin to address some of the selectivity bias that Paul was mentioning, insofar as if we can figure out ways to take something we've lived or felt and think about how that might manifest or apply even to situations, life situations that are very far away from our own, that can start to bridge some of those gaps.
Paul, what is the empathy altruism hypothesis?
This is an idea proposed by Dan Batson that if you feel empathetic towards somebody, you'll feel altruistic towards them. That is, if you put yourself in someone's shoes, you'll then be more likely to help them. And there's a lot of evidence that this is true. If you want to actually get somebody to help somebody else, a good way to do it is to say, try to experience the world as he's experiencing it, as she's experiencing it. And Leslie's exactly right. The extension of empathy, some of it I think is automatic. So if you're standing in front of somebody and you see them scream or flinch or cut their hand, you might do this just instinctively. But a lot of our empathy is extended through our imagination, and it's directed. We can willingly direct it towards some people, not to others.
Do we know about the roots of not feeling empathy? Is a child who's been neglected or abused, for example, less likely to feel empathy?
You know, there's a lot of controversy over this because people would talk a lot about humans differing in their degree of empathy they could feel. With people with autism, very low. With people with psychopathy, very low. With some people, very high. But there's a lot of work now suggesting, and this is, again, sympathetic to what Leslie was saying, that it's not so much a difference in experiencing it, but as willingness to deploy it, willingness to use it. And I think it would well be that a child who's grown up in horrible circumstances might not want to put himself out there and feel empathy for too many others.
A willingness to deploy empathy. I love that idea. Leslie Jamison, it seems like you think of yourself as someone who experiences empathy to a large degree and had that willingness to deploy it. Do you think that you experience it at a higher degree than others?
Well, I too love that phrase, willingness to deploy, and in large part, you know, it connects and offers a nice kind of umbrella phrasing for some of these ideas about intentionality and the choices that you can make to make yourself more vulnerable to empathy happening, that more passive, intuitive sense of it. I'm not really invested in believing that I'm more or less empathetic than anyone. I have simply lived my own life and felt the ways that that life has made me curious about the lives of others, and felt the difficulties also, like the moments of resistance and friction when my desire to imagine the experience of other people has come up against some kind of limitation, like some sort of gap that felt a little bit insoluble. That unbridgeable sort of final 10% between myself and somebody else's life is really compelling to me, and acknowledging that persistent gap feels really ethically important to me. So it's not necessarily that I'm any more capable or willing to deploy, but just that I've found myself preoccupied, maybe, or I've been willing to deploy words in the service of articulating my preoccupations.
You also investigate your, you know, what incentives you have for feeling empathy, and sometimes you even question whether sometimes it's a selfish impulse to be able to somehow claim a share of the pain that somebody else is feeling so you get a little attention yourself.
Absolutely. And that to me connects back to some of what Paul was saying earlier about possibly adaptive facets of empathy, or the kinds of functions that might serve in building communities or in sort of in help. And we want to empathize with others because we also want them to empathize with us. That's something I'm interested in. And certainly this way that empathy can be extended or offered as a gift, but there is also something self-serving about it, not only because maybe we want something back, but also because it becomes a kind of identity ratification. We feel good about ourselves because we empathize with others, or I've felt good about myself because I've empathized with others. And in thinking about what empathy can be or how we can inhabit it well, I'm also really interested in thinking about what's tricky or perilous or self-serving about it. Sort of being willing to look at all those parts of it feels like an important element of a fuller embrace of its possibilities.
Could I jump in on that?
Yes, please.
I think Leslie is both now and in her essays very, very sophisticated about the strengths and weaknesses of empathy. And I think it's worth keeping in mind that it's not the case that the more empathy, the better. I've argued that empathy could lead us to really bad choices at a public policy level. But even something like seeing a doctor. I mean, I want a doctor who understands what's wrong with me, who could make connect with me. But if I'm in pain and misery and terror, I don't want my doctor to be in pain and misery and terror. And if I have some wrong ideas, I don't want my doctor to have the wrong ideas. What I want is somebody who cares about me, but at the same time has some necessary distance through which compassion could be effective and valuable. Too much empathy could be a hindrance.
Yeah, I was thinking about some of exactly those issues in the encounter that we were discussing earlier with the man who will now be known as the male doctor. But when he was asking me sort of questions about what I was going through, instead of simply saying, oh, that must feel hard or that must feel bad, I think part of why that felt so good to me and felt like such a productive manifestation of empathy was precisely for the reasons Paul was articulating. He wasn't just echoing back to me the difficulty and uncertainty of my situation. He was offering me an alternative stance, a stance that had to do with what would happen next. And that was actually more, it sort of spoke to what I needed in that moment more than simply reflecting my affective state back to me would have.
I'm speaking with Leslie Jamison, the author of The Empathy Exams, and Paul Bloom, Yale professor of psychology and cognitive science. We're talking about empathy on this week's Please Explain. If you have a question, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692. Leave a comment on our show page or find us on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. We will look more about when empathy leads us astray after the break. I'm Anna Sale, in for Leonard Lopate. And in this week's Please Explain, we're looking all about empathy. Paul Bloom, professor of psychology and cognitive science at Yale University, is with us. So is Leslie Jamison, the author of a new book of essays called The Empathy Exams. We're also taking your calls with questions about empathy and how it operates, what's good about it, what its drawbacks are. 212-433-9692 is the phone number. You can go to our show page at WNYC or leave a comment on Facebook or Twitter. Donald in Greenwich, Connecticut, what did you want to add to the conversation about empathy?
Well, I've been a 30, thank you. I've been a 35 member. I'm active, very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm a run-of-the-mill garden variety alcoholic. I arrived there afraid and no self-esteem, very, very lonely. And it's all empathy that has taken me to this life that I could not describe, being that everyone seems to have the same emotional and spiritual journey. Our drunkologues are different, but our emotional and spiritual journeys seem to be so similar, and that's where we get hope, and if we hang around long enough, that's where we get recovery from all that.
So you mean that empathy has helped you with that feeling of isolation? You felt a sense of connection.
Empathy is the whole answer for all of us, in my opinion, in Alcoholics Anonymous or the other 12-step programs.
Thank you for your call, Donald. Paul Bloom, talk about empathy and the recovery process.
I think the caller makes an excellent point that the connection you get with another person, knowing that someone else feels what you feel, is immensely valuable. I think it's essential for recovery. It's essential for therapy. It's actually essential for intimate relations in general. But I would gently disagree that this is all that's going on, or even that you know, the more of this, the better. So just take any therapeutic relationship. If I'm lonely, if I'm miserable, if I have, you know, wrong beliefs about the world, I don't want my therapist to empathize with those. I want him or her to understand those and appreciate those and then say, look, you know, you're getting it wrong. You know, I don't see the world like you do. I'm going to try, I care about you, and I'm going to try to gently nudge you into seeing the world in a different way. And, you know, our spouses and our partners aren't our therapists, but there's some of that going on in a healthy relationship, too. you know, I'm in a panic about something, I don't want my wife to panic. I want her to say, you're taking this way too seriously.
You've written about the drawbacks of relying on empathy alone in decision-making, including a piece in The New Yorker called The Case Against Empathy. Do you think we're confusing words and not focusing enough on the importance of being able to disagree with kindness?
I think you're exactly right. I think people often conflate empathy with just doing good and being moral. And if you see it that way, what could be wrong with empathy? But empathy and being a good person is very different. So think about the things we do. You know, if all you did was rely on empathy, you would always care more about the suffering of a little girl stuck in a well than about global warming or you know, massive poverty or whatever. Because we're always, empathy draws us to the individual. And in the cases that Leslie's talking about, where there is an individual who's suffering, empathy is at its most powerful. But when it comes to deciding whether or not to go to war or what taxes to have or something like that, empathy is an awful guide. Because empathy, for instance, is enumerate. It doesn't care about the numbers. Empathy is racist in that it biases you towards people who look like you and act like you against others. And I think we're much better off to go by intuitions of fairness and justice and our sense of what would make the better world.
Leslie Jamison, you write about going to a conference with people who say they're suffering from Morgellons disease. It gets right at this question of feeling empathy versus pursuing truth, because there's a question at the heart of the essay of whether this is actually a medical condition.
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful case to think about some of these questions of when is empathy the useful response, or when is pushing back against somebody's narrative of his or her own life the more useful response. Morgellons is a controversial skin disorder. People who suffer from it report having inexplicable fibers coming up out of their skin, but most doctors would agree that it's a more complicated kind of psychosomatic reaction. And when I went to this conference of Morgellons sufferers, I went in with an idea of what a beautiful thing this conference would be, that people who felt misunderstood by the medical establishment could find a kind of solidarity and solace in each other's company. But I did start to feel when I was there some of what Paul was mentioning about the limitations of simply having an experience affirmed. Sometimes that's not actually what's going to make the experience easier or better. And so I started to feel that there was also potentially something a little bit destructive happening in that sort of mirroring that was happening at that conference.
Allison, in Summit, New Jersey, you have another negative side of empathy you want to bring up.
Yeah, just I have a third grade daughter, and I noticed that she experiences this kind of world sorrow or overwhelming empathy. Like if she's in class and one of the students next to her gets yelled at by the teacher, she internalizes it and can't function. She worries about that person. She experiences all those emotions. Or, you know, other classmates, if they're crying or she's completely distracted and concerned, and then she comes home and she'll just kind of go on and on. It's almost like paralyzing for her, going through everything that was done bad to these different individuals, and she's just paralyzed by it. She just kind of ruminates on it in her mind, and she can't, it affects her learning, you know. So I think there's a point that, you know, in terms of separation, the feelings that we have and emotions that we can, you know, put ourselves feeling for other people, and it can be paralyzing as well. So
Allison, what do you say to your daughter as a parent when she's having those moments of feeling paralyzed?
I tell her that it's okay to worry about other people, but you have to, you know, get your worrier intact and, you know, and call it into question and say, I'm going to worry about this person, you know, worry about this for this long, and then I need to make sure that I keep learning, you know. I don't know, it sounds heartless, but it's like, it can be paralyzing for someone. I'm sure maybe you've known people that worry so much about other people that it paralyzes their own ability to function.
Thank you for your call, Allison. And Paul Bloom, I think that gets one of the central psychological questions of caring for others versus having boundaries, right?
I think it does. I mean, Allison's behavior towards her daughter seems to me exactly right. And you know, I'm very optimistic about this sort of thing. We learn as we grow up to control our empathy. We learn to put it on, keep it under wraps, to extend it, and sometimes, you know, to staunch it. And I think that's part of growing up to be a successful and happy person, but also being a good person. So if you think about people who devote their lives to helping others, they're not actually extremely empathetic people. They're people often motivated by a sense of justice and compassion. But Empathy has two drawbacks. One is what Allison points out, which is it could be paralyzing in the immediate situation. And then the second one is, in the long term, if you're a doctor, a therapist, a social worker, and you feel tremendous empathy for everybody you deal with, you're not going to last a year because their problems will blur into yourself. You need some distance, some boundaries, as you put it.
Alex in Kew Gardens, you have a question about how empathy works. You there?
Right, I'm here. Thank
you.
Go ahead. I actually have a two-pronged question. Are richer people less empathetic, and also are more attractive people less empathetic? Because in my personal experience, I have found this to be true, but I don't know if that's a scientific fact or anything.
Thanks for your question, Alex. That's a good one. Does privilege make you less empathetic? Paul?
I don't really know the answer for sure. There's some evidence, some studies have come out that people who are rich actually are, just even in the same circumstances, less generous and less kind to others. I wouldn't read too much into those studies. And I think the attractiveness is actually in the same question twice, because attractive people are rich, attractive people are fortunate. And then the question is, does being fortunate kind of blind you to the suffering of others? And it might to some extent. There's a lot of evidence that when you're successful, you're prone to think that your success is due to your positive traits, your hard work. And that one consequence of this is those in the world who are less successful, it must be their own fault. And so, well, if you're suffering, you look at the world in a very different way. And so in that regard, being very successful at life, good-looking, smart, rich, can, I think, impair your suffering, your empathy, and also even your compassion.
Leslie Jamison, as you moved around investigating empathy and who you felt drawn to, did you find that you felt more empathetic with people who you felt close to, or whose situation in life you could more, intimately understand?
I'm sure that I probably did in ways that are, as of yet, still it's not necessarily visible to me. But I think that some of how I can imagine that playing out is I tend to be more comfortable engaging with people when there's some sort of common ground we can start on. So just the simple ability to have a conversation that moves well, where it feels like we're exchanging things, is easier if there's some territory for us to rest on and a shared territory that we can converse about. But part of what I was interested in, I think this is part of where the title comes from, this idea of exams, is I was very drawn to putting myself in situations where I was examining what empathy felt like for people whose lives were quite different from mine. So a man who was incarcerated, a woman who believed herself to suffer from a disease I didn't ever necessarily believe in. And thinking about, I felt that empathy was still possible in those situations, even across kind of gaps and differences. And I think that to nets back to this, what I thought was a pretty fascinating question about privilege and empathy, which is to say that that's where imagination, it seems to me, comes into play. And that's where trying to confess the subjective biases of our own, the positions we always speak from, is important. So to think, well, maybe there are these subterranean forces influencing how empathetic I can be or what some of the barriers to empathy are. But the more that we talk about those and bring them into the light, the more we give ourselves the opportunity to transcend them.
Paul Bloom, what do you make of policymakers appealing to our empathy? I mean, President Obama has called for Americans to be more empathetic. He's talked about it when it comes to the Middle East crisis, and Israelis and Palestinians and calling for more empathy. How does that sound to you?
I'm not a fan of it. I think it's a tool. And policymakers on every side will use it to enact the policies that they want. But there's an illusion that people have, which is that their side has more empathy than the other side. And I think, in fact, what the sides differ in political debates is who they focused empathy on. So if you're in favor of gun control, you'll try to get people to feel empathetic towards the victims of gun violence. If you're against gun control, you'll get people to feel empathetic to those who are defenseless having their guns taken away. So I think in some way I would rather our leaders like Obama make arguments based on more cold-blooded, cost-benefit calculations. Say, if we do it this way, people will be better off. Don't put yourself into these people's shoes. And then a final twist on this is that empathy is used not just to motivate positive actions, but also when a country goes to war, for instance, one of the things that a leader will do is try to instill empathy for the suffering of victims that motivate going to war, like Syrian victims of chemical warfare.
Leslie Jamison, why do you think empathy has become such a popular word? It shows up, we heard it in a radio promo before this segment started. We hear it in political discourse. We hear it in instructions about how to think about bullying in schools. Why is this word all over the place?
Well, I think part of it comes from what we were talking about earlier, this way that empathy can become a tool for self-ratification in certain ways. I mean, I think it's a way that, you know, there are so many different discourses of self-help and self-betterment that I think are especially popular now. And I think empathy is a way that a word around which certain senses of good citizenship, as Paul was talking about, have gathered and accrued. So I think it's part of this idea that we can sort of keep reforming ourselves into ideal people, and that one of the muscles that we need to tone is empathy. And so what are all the different ways that we're going to tone it? I also think that the rise of digital culture, in terms of thinking about what's palpably different and how we relate to strangers now than how we related to strangers 50 years ago. I mean, there are all these ways that we're connected to other lives and kind of artifactual constructions of personal lives. So things like Twitter feeds and Facebook profiles, and we're getting these individuals constantly presented as these little artifacts that we can consume at a great distance. And so I think thinking about what actually constitutes intimacy or knowledge of another life under those circumstances, all of those questions are being framed in a new media structure right now.
Paul Bloom, in addition to empathy, what words would you focus us on when we think about living a moral life?
Compassion, justice, fairness, consequences. I mean, I'm not empathy. Is, I think, in some degree essential for intimate relationships. But I think we should realize as well that it's not the be-all and end-all. And sometimes our empathy could be misguided, sometimes it could be selfish. I think we should just kind of put empathy in its place as something important, but only part of the overall story of morality.
And Paul, just a question to pick up on the digital culture point that Leslie was just making. You know that people face-to-face treat people differently than they do when they're talking online, when they're making comments on internet sites. Does seeing someone affect the way we experience empathy?
I think it does. I think that in some way, Facebook and Twitter and the like have this enormous chance to enhance empathy towards people because it puts me in contact with people I would never otherwise see. But I think you're also right that the feeling is diminished. The feeling, there's tremendous burden on the imagination. Well, if I'm face to face with somebody, just, you know, literally looking at their face, empathy is triggered at this deep level, and experience is very different. I think for this reason, you know, communicating over the phone or by Skype or whatever will never replace really being in a room with somebody and looking at them physically.
I've been speaking with Paul Bloom, professor of psychology and cognitive science at Yale University, and Leslie Jamison, author of the collection of essays, The Empathy Exams. They've been in today for our Please Explain on Empathy. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you for having me.